From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Paula Poundstone is the first female to win a Cable ACE Award. She's also picked up an American Comedy Award for Best Female Stand-Up Comic. In 2019, she might be best known as a frequent panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. About 2 years ago, she told me that most of her work on that show is unscripted. But despite her uncanny ability to make air funny by breathing it, as Wait, Wait host Peter Sagal has said, she writes. She's written for the Los Angeles Times, Glamour, had a regular column in Mother Jones, and she's the author of two books, There's Nothing in This Book That I Meant to Say, and more recently, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Her podcast, Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone, drops weekly with co-host and fellow comedian Adam Felber. She comes to Wilmington Saturday, June 22nd for a 7:30 performance at the Wilson Center at Cape Fear Community College, and she joins us today via Skype through NPR West in Los Angeles. Paula Poundstone, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. And today's conversation, as a reminder to our listeners, is pre-recorded. So Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, says about you, Paula Poundstone is the funniest human being I have ever known. Everything she does, thinks, or says is hilarious. If you cut her into bits, each piece would be funny, but don't. Air becomes funny having been breathed by her. When did you learn that you make air funny? Were you a class cut up when you were a kid?
You know, the first sentence of the summary letter written by my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Bump, in May of 1969 said, I have enjoyed many of Paula's humorous comments about our activities. At least Mrs. Bump enjoyed my sense of humor. I have to say that subsequent years, the comment letters from the teachers were not as flattering.
We know that you're kind of an archivist, and so you would have kept those comments from your kindergarten teacher, but do you remember any of that? Do you remember the activities that she was talking about that you commented on?
No, I don't. No, I mean, I must have been doing a tight five on Plato. I don't. I mean, I remember kindergarten still, but I don't remember saying anything particularly of music while I was there. But I'll tell you, I was very, my parents kept the report cards in a drawer in the kitchen for a while anyways. And so that letter was in this drawer in the kitchen. And I remember taking it out and reading it with great pride many a time. Perhaps it was a salve for the subsequent letters that came from schools. I would take it out to comfort myself. I mean, in the first grade, Miss Carter said that I was prone to emotional outbursts and I needed tutored in handwriting. So it was really downhill after kindergarten.
Did your parents encourage that? Were they funny?
I think they were. I think that my father and my grandfather were often doing W.C. Fields, and I didn't know it because he was part of their pop culture. Not until I saw a documentary made by my friend Bob Boyde about W.C. Fields did I go like, oh, I get it. It's like if my kids had never seen, what was the Dana Carvey movie where they'd go like, not,
Wayne's World?
I didn't see it either, but I remember that the expression where, you'd say something and then you'd go, not, really entered into, our public discourse. Everybody used to say that. So it'd be like if my kids heard me say that and thought I had invented it. my father never made a joke and then said, I stole that from W.C. Fields. But I think my father was funny.
So at what point did you say, yep, I'm going to make a living as a stand-up comic? This is actually a thing.
Soon. I haven't. I haven't committed. I'm like Joe Biden, where, I haven't announced yet, but it's clear that I'm running.
So we actually talked, I think it was 2016, before the presidential election. And this would have been...
Remember when there
was hope? Say that again?
I said, remember when there was hope? You should play that interview again just to feel the difference. Like my stomach probably wasn't in knots all the time the way it is now.
Is it? So how do you deal with this from a comedic perspective? Because you also, you came here after that in 2017 and you did a show, and in the beginning of the show, you did kind of a disclaimer about your political humor, and you said, everybody's fair game, everybody's a target, and yeah, I'm going to make jokes about the president and deal with it. I know you travel a lot. You may not remember this.
You know, I'll tell you, Trump today is trying to say that the Russians had nothing to do with him being elected, and obviously that's not true. But I can tell you, as a person who is with a crowd in various parts of the country on a regular basis, there is a decided difference between the, during the campaign, I felt like, everybody made jokes about Trump. I thought that's what he was there for, quite honestly. But everybody made jokes about Trump. And I think even if people were Trump supporters, there was a lightheartedness about it. But I think what happened is that social media campaign that the Russians attacked us with was effective. And so as time went on, it was like, I just felt this tension in the crowd sometimes over mentioning Trump. And so I tried this new approach. Like, I tried a few different things. So I tried this new approach at one point. I said to myself, because I had always had Republicans and Democrats in my crowd, probably more Democrats, but nonetheless, people that came out to laugh for the night and to enjoy the stuff that we have in common. So I decided, that I didn't like having this fractious feeling in the room, and I would try a new approach. So what I decided to do was I would come out and I would tell the crowd. I decided that I would not tell the crowd that I was a Democrat. And then I realized, like, even if I don't bring it up, even if I never said a word about Trump or any other political, figure, if people would guess that I'm a Democrat, because there's stuff that I say that indicates that I feel there's an important role for government to play in our lives. Right. Here's just one example. I feel very strongly that there should be a law that in hotels, the shampoo and conditioner has to be labeled in a large font. When I say that, people automatically know that I'm a Democrat.
Right away,
Republicans are grousing in the back of the room, just government involved in shampoo and conditioner. That's because they never put lotion on their head, I guess.
When you were here in 2017 and you did that, you presented as I'm not either and everybody is fair game and we punch up and all of that. There, I don't know how far into the show you were, but it may be 15 minutes and some people in the front row got up and said, fuck you, and walked out. And then you, Caitlin, we're going to have to bleep that. And then we...
Don't. It was authentic.
And then you, I mean, it was shocking. It was shocking to everybody because, you kind of said, well, did they know what show they were coming to? And then you used that throughout the rest of the show. And I wondered,
battle scars from it. That's
yeah.
And PTSD from, do you know, I remember that night. And I have to tell you there might have been one other night right around that same time, one other night where somebody, said something and, got mad at me or something. Other than that, that's the only time that happened. But it was right during that time when I realized, oh my gosh, I have to do something. I have to change or I have to say something. I have to do something so that, I thought those people were a little bit weird because, yes, they were sitting down front. If I didn't enjoy a show, I might write a letter. I wouldn't get up and make a fuss.
Right.
I might walk out quietly, but I wouldn't make it, I wouldn't make it about me. And so I thought the whole thing was a little bit strange. And looking back, one of those people did look a little bit like Vladimir Putin. I have no way of authenticating that now. I think they may have been puppets of the Russian regime, maybe.
And it was just interesting because as a stand-up comic, you have to deal with hecklers all the time, but this was different. And it seemed like it really landed kind of personally for you.
It was weird. And it was the thing that made me think to myself, like, uh-oh, I have to. Because here's the thing. I want people to come out and have a good time. Yeah. I want to have the freedom to go wherever. I mean, I don't know if you noticed this, but I have no act. So what happens to me, my entire performance is a byproduct of the fact that I have obsessive compulsive disorder, which manifests itself differently in different people, although we all have it. The main symptom for me is that I can't stop talking. And what happens is everything that gets said reminds me of one more thing that I feel that I must say. And so I'm like, it's like a pool table or a pinball machine, you know, thoughts sort of, I ricochet in one direction or the other. And I just have to have the freedom to be able to do that.
You're listening to Coastline. Paula Poundstone is my guest today. When we come back from this short break, we'll find out how many animals she has in 2019 and what she learned about her unscientific study of the search for human happiness. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Paula Poundstone is with us today via Skype from NPR West. If you're a fan of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you know her as one of the funniest panelists on NPR's Comedy News Quiz show. She has a weekly podcast called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. And she's written two books, the most recent, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. We'll explore that in a moment. She is coming to Wilmington to perform on June 22nd at the Wilson Center at Cape Fear Community College. Our conversation today is pre-recorded. So this unscientific search for human happiness, how did this evolve into the idea for a book?
I just have to tell you one thing before we go to that, which is just before we took that break, there was a stringed instrument that started playing low volume and then got louder and louder as if it was coming towards you, and then you were gone. I tried to call out to you, just look out behind you. Stringed instrument, and then you were just gone. I'd never been so scared in my entire life. So the totally unscientific study of the search for human happiness. I've thought of this idea of doing these experiments. I knew that the experiments themselves would be playgrounds for writing jokes. Right. So what I did was I did things that either I or other people thought would make me happy. So I knew that the experiments themselves would be playgrounds for writing jokes. But the thing is, to me, the measure of happiness, it's not the same as enjoyment. Like if I were to go up in a Ferris wheel today, I would have a great time because I like Ferris wheels. But I couldn't say that it would make me happy. It wouldn't give me like a lasting uplift for when I returned to the trenches of my, you know, my daily toil. Every chapter of my book is written as an experiment with the hypothesis and the conditions and the variables and the qualitative and quantitative observations and the field notes But the analysis part of each chapter is where I tell people about how my regular life is going, which at the time was raising a house full of kids and animals, being a stand-up comic, and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. And that's where I think that I can determine if the variable was giving me happiness.
What is a HEP of happiness?
It's a, I decided that, you know, we have no measure for happiness. And so I decided to come up with my own measurement, standardized measurement. Perhaps it's slightly less than standardized. There's about 4 HEPs in a Baloo of happiness.
So that makes a lot of sense, and it sounds scientific. But you have videos, these short videos on your website, and some of them show you having a really good time dancing with friends. And you talked at one point about Trisha Yearwood impressing you on Wait, Wait, so you invited her over for ping pong. How did that go? Did she come?
No, she's not. I keep inviting her. I keep inviting her, and she keeps not coming. In fairness, it'll be like a Saturday in July, and, it turns out she and Garth Brooks are playing at, like, Yankee Stadium that night. And I always say to her, well, just don't go there. Just tell Garth, who I would love to have as well, but, you know, maybe that night they need to divide the labor. And she comes to play ping pong, and he stays and sings. In Yankee Stadium. I've been shocked each time at the choices she's made.
Who else have you invited over for ping pong?
You know, for 15 years, I sent invitations to Dick Van Dyke.
Oh. 50.
And one night, a couple years ago, ping pong party had started up. We used to have 5 or 6 a year. And now I'm down to like about 2 a year because my kids aren't at home and I don't have them there to help me. But one night a couple of years ago, somebody runs out to the backyard where we play ping pong. He goes, Dick Van Dyke's in your living room. And I went in the house, and by golly, there he was. And, we don't know each other well. We've met at events before, but we don't know each other well. And I said to him, I said, Dick, I've been sending you invitations for 15 years. I said, did you know who the invitations were from? He said, yeah. Okay, I just wanted to make sure it was a real rejection. I want to make sure I'm not overlooking anything in my ability to read a room. He didn't play ping pong. He didn't play ping pong, which I was glad of. I mean, because he's, you know, 90. I don't know. Now he might be 93. I think at the time he might have been 91. And I just don't want to be the person, you know, who broke Dick Van Dyke. But I use plastic, you know, silverware and, well, it's not silverware, plasticware, utensils, and plastic disposable, according to the label on the plates, but plates, and we serve pizza and junk food mostly. And but what my guests have never realized is that those are the same plates. I, at the end of the party, go through the trash. And I take those plates out again, and I wash them and reuse them because I hate the idea of throwing away plastic. And so this party was so populated, the one that we had when Dick Van Dyke came, that all of a sudden, you know, people start going, wow, there's no more plates. There's no more plates. And so me and another friend of mine, I'm like, come here, I need your help. And she comes and we're pulling the plates out of the trash right beside Dick is sitting in a chair right beside where we're pulling these plates out of the trash. And I noticed that I offered him food after that, and he was like, no, I'm good. Thanks.
What was it about that party? Why do you think he finally showed up, and has he been back since?
He has not been back since. I think he got as much out of it as he could. I don't know. I mean, I guess he just cracked. I guess, you know, 15 years is the charm. We had another friend in common who told him what a good time the parties are, and that's why he finally came. It had zero to do with me. But it was fun. It was great. It was so exciting.
Is ping pong part of your search for human happiness? Is it a tool? Does it help you release oxytocin?
It absolutely does. You know, the publisher insisted that I write like some additional material for the paperback, which I was loath to do because I felt like I had, come full circle with what I already had on the page. But they, they just hammered me about it. And so I ended up doing one additional experiment, and that was playing ping pong. I decided to play ping pong all day. So what I did was I scheduled, it wasn't like a big party, but I scheduled players, friends, to come play me from, I forget what time we started. Was it, 8 in the morning or something until 8 at night. And it was fantastic. It was so much fun. It's a great game. It's just, what we usually do at my parties is we play doubles. You pick names out of a hat for your partner. And when I ask people to come a lot, if I meet somebody, I'll say, do you play ping pong? And they'll go, well, not very well. I go, perfect. So there's not really great players necessarily, but it's just so much fun, And I'll tell you, for the most part, the only time people have their phones out at those parties is to take pictures. For the most part, there's every now and then somebody will say, well, who was in that movie? And somebody takes out their flat thing to Google who was in a movie, which is, by the way, the worst thing you can do for your brain.
And
you need to think about it, right? You need to figure it out. Ask somebody else, not Google it. But anyways, my point being that really it's just so much fun to be with one another and have real exchanges. And people don't even know each other, that when they're paired up as partners, they'll win a point and hug each other. It's really fun. My only social life, by the way, too.
People who are familiar with your work pretty much know about your rants against technology and what they're doing to our brain and the fact that there's actually an addiction going on. Do you have a rule in your house when people come over about technology? And I'm not talking about your kids right now because I'm going to ask about them later. But just guests.
No, I don't. I don't. But I do have to say, even on that day where we played ping pong all day, there was a point at which one person took out their flat thing for some reason. And I remember she had some explanation as to why she needed to do that. And I didn't say anything. It's not my place to say anything. But when I went to write the chapter reflecting on this great day of playing ping pong, it was kind of the waste product in the pool. It really was just like, oh, it's so much fun until somebody had to do that. Because it just, everybody's focus changes. I don't know, especially in our house. Our house was our house was a bit ravaged by addiction in general, I suppose. But in this case, I'm specifically referring to electronics addiction. My son, I stupidly put him in front of a computer when he was 3 because I didn't know any better, because we were told by those companies that they were educational, which was never true, remains not true. And not only are they not educational, but they're specifically designed to be addictive. So that took its course. And so I have the idea that somebody would take out their flat thing in the midst of a social engagement in my house is a little striking. I guess, it would be like, it would be like lighting up around Humphrey Bogart.
So you learned to swing dance as part of this experiment in the totally unscientific study of the search for human happiness. And then you have this video of you swing dancing with a bunch of folks on your website. So does that mean that's still a practice that you engage in, you kept from your time doing research for the book?
No, I did for a long time. Actually, I did continue. I took swing dance and tap dance with a terrific woman in Los Angeles named Rusty Frank. But I ended, there was a point at which because as I did these experiments, there was stuff that I liked doing. And most of those things I quit after the experiment in order to isolate the variables.
Right.
But I continued with, well, I jettisoned somewhat from swing dance to tap, for one thing, and then we would still do some swing. So I sort of continued with some form anyways of dancing, if you can call it that when I do it. And the only other thing that I didn't give up, well, okay, one of the chapters, ironically, was the Get Wired chapter, where I learned how to use a computer. At that point, this is several years ago, computers have been around for a long time. I personally came to it late. I mean, we had the big kind, but I didn't know how to use it. But I bought a laptop and learned how to use it. And the irony, actually, you know, when I went to do the rewrite on the book, after I'd finally sent in the first draft, I get these notes back from the editor. And she pointed out to me, particularly in that chapter, like, you know, how you don't want to repeat the same word all the time, you know, like description. How many times I said lonely, frustrated, and tired in that chapter. It was like astounding. And I hadn't done it. It wasn't like, I didn't like repeat it purposely. It just that as I was reporting, because that's what I would do. I would say I took a dance lesson or say I took a Taekwondo lesson, which is another thing. I did a workout thing for a while. I would come home and take notes on that experience. And then I would also take notes on how life was going in general. And then I would bang that into a chapter. And so just over time with the Get Wired experiment, I when I read it back to myself, I was deeply humiliated by how many times I used those words. I was like, wow. But it really, it was interesting because I was sort of, to some degree, since I was just beginning learning to use the computer at that point, I kind of, it was a valid experiment in some ways that by that time, a lot of people didn't realize what it was doing to them because they were already much further down the road than I was with it. But those, early notes were kind of eye-opening in a way that I certainly hadn't intended.
Maybe it's more scientific than you think.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. I'm listening to
the... That's to take me up as a result of my work.
I'm listening to the book on Audible, read by you, which not only means that I get the benefit of all the character voices, but there are also not just sound effects, but there are these whole scenes created through audio that, of course, the book reader completely misses. Can you talk about the decision to engage at that level of production? Was that your idea? And do you think more people download the audiobook or the hard copy?
Oh, I don't know about the, yeah, I don't know who does what. The I had a really terrific engineer. And he brought a lot of that to it. When I was a little bit on the fence, whether, you know, how sort of pure and genuine I, you know, how, well, not, yeah, but how pure I wanted, should it only be my voice reading or should it be other things? But I had heard, like when my kids were little, we had to do a lot of driving around for one appointment and this appointment. I live in Los Angeles, and so you're stuck in the car a lot. And so we began listening from the library. We went through almost every children's book, the audio version of almost every children's book in our library at one point. I heard like a variety of styles of doing it. And some of the ones that had, you know, not too heavy-handed, but, you know, music going in and out and maybe a little something backing something up was actually enhanced it and made it more fun to listen to. So when he proposed some of these ideas, I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And he, his name is Jorge Reyes, and he really did a fantastic job.
Yeah, and I did not know that you did character voices the way you do them.
Well, I'm flattered. I don't think anybody knew that. I'm not sure I knew that.
So I'd have to get to the animal question. How many do you have at this point, and how many of them are cats?
Well, I'm down now.
I'm sorry.
I was just saying to my daughter last night, I can't believe I only have 13 cats. But I have 13 cats. My daughter and I went to see Les Miserables last night, and I have a new puppy 16 weeks old, and then I have another dog, that a big dog, is 8 years old, and so it was the first time that the puppy had been left like alone for a while, yeah. And we came back last night, and between the dogs and the cats, there was cat throw up all over the house. They had peed in the litter box, but I have the kind that has the lid on it, the sort of pagoda lid thing, and they had managed to pee straight through the crack in the lid and the box itself, and it was all on the floor underneath. And then there was stuff in that litter box that can't be described. It was just horror. I think Apocalypse Now. It was so awful. And then the dog, you know, when she was fine until she saw us come through the door, and then she was so excited that she peed all over the cage. It was interesting that I had come from seeing Les Miserables, and I was miserable. The whole thing made Fantine's experience seem bearable.
Oh, how do you get to 12 cats? I mean, people have asked you that before, and you've said, well, four of them died, but how do you get up to that number? Rescuing them?
Say, how did you get 13 cats? And I say, I can tell you exactly how I got 13 cats. I had 16 and three died.
Right.
That's how I tell it.
Tell me about this when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. Paula Poundstone is my guest today. When we come back from this short break, the verdict on whether raising kids and caring for animals contributes to human happiness. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Paula Poundstone appears regularly on NPR's weekly news quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You may have also heard her during the Garrison Keillor years on A Prairie Home Companion. Maximum Fun produces a weekly podcast called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone with Adam Felber. She's written two books. The most recent, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, came out in 2017, and she's coming to Wilmington to perform Saturday, June 22nd, at the Wilson Center at CFCC. She's joining us now via Skype, courtesy of NPR West. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. So, Paula Poundstone, how did you get to 13 cats? At what point do you say, we're full, we can't take any more, and why do you keep taking them in?
You know what? I remember when I was still in single digits, which I highly recommend. I think I had nine, and we had gone out looking for a kitten, and we went to this place that, like a rescue place, and we got this one cute little kitten, and it turned out that they had like the foster thing where somebody takes care of them just for a little while, and that kitten had a litter mate, and they decided that they wanted the two of them together. So I had taken, now I was at 10 with that one, and then they're like, oh, won't you take this other one? And at first I was like, no, 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 enough, enough, enough. And then they just hammered me, and so I took the second one. Now I was at 11. And after 11, I just felt it didn't matter anymore. I lost my any kind of self-control. I'll tell you something. I may be part cat because if you go to your shelter, if you go to your local shelter in, say, April or May, and you're looking for a kitten, they likely, you know, they might have a little bit, but not a lot of it. But if you go in June, they're packed. They have tons of kittens because there's a kitten season.
Yeah.
And what I find, without even before I knew that, sometime in April or May, I would start to crave the idea of having a kitten. And so I think I might be part cat. I think that I crave a kitten right around the time that cats are mating. And I don't think dogs have, I don't think it's like puppy season. Dogs have sex year round and not even necessarily with other dogs. You can get a dog that's part German Shepherd and part your neighbor's shin.
Are there other animals in the Poundstone household?
We used to have a bearded dragon for many years. We kept that dragon alive for a long, long time. Daisy, the bearded dragon. And we used to have bunnies for a long time. We had bunnies too.
Did you let them hop around the house, or were they in cages?
They were in hutches outside, and then we would put them in a pen, like a foldable pen that we would put out. We used to call it putting the bunnies out for a hop, and put them in this pen and let them hop around a lot. And now, most recently, I got a new puppy. I was working in Skokie, Illinois, and I had said on stage that I wanted a golden retriever mix puppy. And when I came off, the person who ran the theater said, "Hey, were you serious about that?" I said, "Yeah, I am." And so she's, "Well, I know someone who has a rescue." And so the long and the short of it is that that person ended up like a week later hooking me up with a little puppy. And so I flew. I was working in Charlotte, North Carolina on a Saturday. On that Sunday, I flew to Chicago. This woman from the theater picked me up, took me to pick up this puppy, took me back to the Chicago airport where, the plan was that I would now fly home. But the thing is, well, two things. The way they ended up having these puppies was that there was a breeder near them that was making golden doodles for some veterans organization, and good for them. But one of the golden retriever females got out. Somebody left the gate open, and it got knocked up by a Newfoundland. And so they didn't want those puppies. So on that day that I flew to Chicago, this was about 6 weeks ago or maybe 7 weeks ago now, there was a fluke storm in Chicago, and there was bad weather all around the country. It was one of the worst travel days in recent history, and everything was stopped. So now I'm in the airport, can't get anywhere. I stayed in the airport for almost 24 hours with this puppy, and I had already paid American Airlines for me to carry it, on with me under the seat in front of me. But then I couldn't get out on American. I had to switch over to United. And United says to me, I as I'm checking in, and this was like 4:30 in the morning, I started standing in line. And now I'm trying to check in for this flight. And I forgot that I had the puppy. It was in a soft cider bag, and it was on the floor. I checked my bags, and now I said, "Oh, yeah, and I have this puppy." And United Airlines, they say to me, they go, "Well, I thought they were going to think it was adorable." And they go, "Well, how old is the puppy?" I said, 10 weeks. They said, "Well, we won't take a puppy that young." And you have to keep in mind, this puppy is part Newfoundland. So in this little soft cider carry-on thing, and it was like a Jiffy Pop container. Every few seconds, this dog was getting bigger. I could see the sides of the bag, expanding while I was standing at the counter. "We have to, how am I going to get home?" They're like, "Well, we can't help with that, ma'am." And I said, "Well, wait a minute. Do you have to have validation of the dog's age?" And they said, "No." I said, "Well, then it's 16 weeks. They're like, "No, ma'am, we can't do that. We can't." So they didn't. I ended up having to go back to American. But anyway, so now I have this giant puppy.
What's the puppy's name?
Mo. She's named after Mo from the Three Stooges, because that's how I roll.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with comedian Paula Poundstone. She comes to Wilmington to perform on Saturday, June 22nd at the Wilson Center at Cape Fear Community College. This edition of Coastline is pre-recorded. So would you say
You were saying that? My puppy grew an inch.
Do these animals make you happy? Like, you do joke a lot about how the cat pee and puke overwhelms you, and you're constantly cleaning it up, and you need a large vehicle to haul around all the nature's miracle that you buy. But is that really the heart of it for you, or do these creatures make you happy?
Oh, I don't know about that. I used to say, I had an assistant years ago who didn't like cats. Which is sort of a weird place for her to work, but she didn't like cats, and she would sort of grouse about the cats. And I used to say to her, "You realize, of course, those cats pay your salary. Those cats write my act, you know." Because my most ardent fans, I think, are the cat people, and they are really like for years. I would come home and my kids, you know, would come in my bedroom while I was unpacking, and there were always like presents for me in my suitcase because audience members bring me stuff, not because they want them to, but they do. And oftentimes it would be like a little gift bag with a cat toy in there. And I remember my kids would pick up the gift bags and they'd always go, "What? Where's this from?" And I'd go, "Oh, I got it at work." So they eventually got jobs. It was nothing disappointing to them that they didn't receive gifts each day when they went in. But a lot of my audience members bring me. I had one audience member that used to bring me. She grew her own catnip, and would give me part of her harvest. Oh man, that's good stuff.
You launched a podcast last summer called "Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone." Where did that idea come from, for the title, anyway?
Oh, just any project I've ever done. You know, I'll have this. I do have a wonderful fan base that I just honestly do love. They are my best friend. But I'll get that like initial layer of people, and then nothing. So I just everything I do, it's like, well, almost. And so I know that's where it came from, was the idea that I was going to have a podcast, but I knew no one would listen to it. And I did another podcast, in fact, with NPR a little while before, called Live from the Poundstone Institute. But we only did 10 episodes, and they were really fun to do. And it was how Adam and I started working as a team together. I had this other podcast experience in my background.
And so what is the concept behind Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone? There's a construct to each episode.
Yeah, sort of barely, but yeah. honestly, that's part of the fun of the whole podcast thing, is that there are no suits. You know, you don't have anybody coming in telling you, well, you know, we want you to do this. We want you to. So you kind of throw stuff up on the wall and see what sticks to some degree. And frankly, you don't even know if it's sticking because you have no. I have people that go on our Facebook page and make comments. And my manager is always trying to draw conclusions from that. She said to us the other day, you know, I know this is only one person. Like somebody on Facebook had said, we have this joke about a guy named Thomas Coyne that we've been looking for. He was, because if there's any construct to the show at all, it's that we would have people that were experts on a topic that I had a, you know, sort of burning question that I came to somewhere in my life. Whether it was, you know, why does my toilet keep stopping up? Or, what are these bugs that are in my house? Because I used to have infestation of the week. We would have an expert on to come tell us real information, and then me and Adam would make jokes. So one time I wanted to know what you should do to survive a bear attack. How do you behave around a bear? And so we got a survivalist. His name was Thomas Coyne. We booked him. He was, it was all set up, and he never showed up. This was like our fourth episode. And we called him, we texted him, we went through all the methods that we used to book him, but we never saw him. So since then, we've been looking for him. And our fans go on our listeners, who call themselves nobodies, they go on our Facebook page and they'll there's an interactive map where they can put where they've looked for him and haven't found him. And this is how we're proceeding to look for Thomas Quine. And so we bring it up a lot. So my manager says the other day, she says to us, she goes, you know, on our Facebook page, one person said that we had beaten the Thomas Quine thing to death. And that was the measure that she was using, was one person. That's right. The kind of data analysis that we have. And so, of course, Adam and I took from that we needed to talk about it more, just to bother that one man. Nate is his name. I can't remember his last name, but it's Nate. And apparently, in Nate's world, you come up with new stuff all the time. Well, Nate, just so you know, we don't.
The question about surviving a bear attack, I mean, you live in a metropolis, and I guess you did, as part of your book research, take your daughter, Tosha, camping in the Angeles Mountains. Is that where that question came from, when you thought you were having an encounter with a bear?
We've never been certain, because I didn't unzip the tent door the way my daughter asked me to. We were... all right, it was entirely my fault. We were camping in the Angeles Forest. It was the last night backpacking, it was me and my daughter, Tosha, and I just decided that I didn't want squirrels taking my Pop-Tarts. And so on the last night, I brought my backpack with the food into the tent, which is apparently a cardinal sin. We were woken at about 1:30 in the morning by very, very loud snuffling outside of the nylon tent wall. I've never known for sure. My daughter goes, unzip the door and put your head out, because she's never liked me that much. I've never known if it was a bear or not. I think that it was. And so we had no idea what to do. What we did was we sang songs from The Harder They Come, because the only thing I do know about bears is that they are very much put off by songs of social struggle. And so we sang from The Harder They Come, and we were just terrified. And then, I don't know, after about 20 minutes or so, it went away. And we were woken up again about 2 hours later by the same thing. And so we like to think of it as our encore. So we sang again, and that time we added hand claps. And again, people, this just to inform your listeners, bears don't like percussion. And one of the ways I know that is, look at Ringo Starr. Has he ever been attacked by a bear? No.
So we have a minute left, so we'll go out on a really light topic. Why did you decide to adopt three kids?
I was so high. I think I had this idea that I was somehow going to make somebody's life better. I don't know if I did that or not, by the way, but in the end, I realized that that's not, I made a family. That's what I did, and I wanted to do that.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Paula Poundstone performs at the Wilson Center at Cape Fear Community College Saturday, June 22nd. Paula Poundstone, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And both Caitlins, fantastic.
Coastline's producer is Caitlin Freund. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.